everyone. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy. And I remember the first time I heard the podcast that's produced by today's guest. My friend Kareem told me about it, and I said, all right, now I gotta go listen to this thing. Dozens of people told me about it before, but Kareem's the guy who told me about Eric Ries about half a decade before the Lean Startup book came out. I gotta go listen if he says it. And I remember listening to a podcast called Startup, going, oh my God. These guys are actually going to build an empire in the podcast world. This thing, podcasting, that I always thought was like a niche-y, geeky thing that I loved that was never going to go anywhere, that I never took seriously, even though I'd been doing it since 2008. They actually were building a company based on that. And they got Chris Sacca to invest, the Twitter guy, the software guy, the guy who's known for being an early investor in Uber. They're really doing it. And as I watched it and watched the company grow, the company behind it, Gimlet, I thought, this is amazing. And I promised myself when I was in high school studying a business, reading biographies of successful people, that if I ever saw someone doing something good, I would never be jealous. I would instead want to learn. How do they do it? And so I wanted to have today's guest on, the founder of Gimlet, which produces that startup podcast that I heard a few years ago and so many others. I have him on, Alex Bloomberg, to talk about how he built up Gimlet into this award-winning podcast company. And we're going to find out about that, about how he's getting listeners. The guy keeps climbing up the charts, and about how he's making this whole thing work, even though he's got, you know, a family at home. This whole thing is sponsored by the company that helped me rebuild my website. It's called TopTal, and the company that, if you're looking at my podcast artwork right now and you like the design, they created it. It's called DesignCrowd. I'll tell you more about them later. Alex, welcome.
Well, thanks. Great to be here.
I've been listening to hours and hours and hours of you speak in preparation for this interview, and it feels to me like the turning point for you when you were working at This American Life and Planet Money was this t-shirt that you put up on Kickstarter.
Yeah, I guess that was. Yeah, that was probably the turning point.
Why? Why did you put a t-shirt up on Kickstarter?
Before becoming the CEO of the Gimlet, I was in not-for-profits my entire life before that. I was a not-for-profit journalist. I worked at public radio. I worked for NPR. I worked at WBEZ. And I worked for a show called This American Life. And then from there, I went on to found with Adam Davidson a show called Planet Money, which is a podcast. Mm-hmm. And I was watching podcasting sort of take off from that perch, you know, at This American Life and at Planet Money. And I kept noticing that our crowds were getting bigger, our audiences were getting bigger. People were really, really engaged with what we were doing. But I was always thinking to myself, well, there's not like money in this really, is there? And I think that's partly because of being in public radio, you sort of are conditioned to think that there's never any money. And then we did this project at Planet Money that sort of changed my mind a little bit on the money equation. And that was this t-shirt project where, so Planet Money is a podcast. It's still going. It's fantastic. It's a podcast about business and economics. And we try to look at the economic forces behind sort of our everyday lives. And we wanted to do this big project, which was we wanted to look at a very, very humble product, the t-shirt, and see how the entire global economy comes together to make that t-shirt. This t-shirt that everybody interacts with every day. There's this whole world behind it. And we wanted to show that world. We wanted to interview the people who made it, interview the people who grew the cotton, interview the people who spun the yarn. And so we did. We set about doing this. And it was this long project in the making. And then we figured, like, we're going to trace this whole thing. And then we're going to have this t-shirt. Maybe our listeners will want to buy that t-shirt. So we figured, like, let's make an opportunity for our listeners to buy that t-shirt. So we did a Kickstarter. And we said, we're going to be doing this project. At the end of it, there's going to be a t-shirt. If you guys want to buy the t-shirt, so, you know, go to our Kickstarter. And we announced it on our podcast. And our podcast at the time had like something like 200,000 listeners. And in the end, over the course of a 2-week Kickstarter campaign, 20,000 of them bought the t-shirt. We raised over $500,000 just on that 1 2-week Kickstarter. And 10% of our audience, of our podcast audience, participated. And I remember thinking, like, man, that says to me that there's enthusiasm, there's willingness to pay, there's money here. Like, if we can do a 2-week Kickstarter and raise $500,000, there's some real, you know, potential for money here.
And you only made that available, I didn't realize this, to the podcast audience, not to the terrestrial radio listening audience?
No, No, oh, because of like weird sort of like public radio sort of like internal issues, there were policies and stuff. We weren't able to politics. We weren't able to talk about it on the radio. Yeah.
Yeah. I looked it up. The goal was $50,000. You posted it on April 30th, 2013, I think it was. It's hard to zoom in. The very next day, I can see very clearly, you guys hit your goal and you blew past it, as you said, by a factor of 10.
Yeah.
So then I was trying to piece together what happened next. And here's what I'm seeing from what you've said before. You started looking around to figure out, can we do more podcasts within NPR? Can I do something on my own? You were inspired by Roman Mars and talked to him. You were inspired by Jeff Ulrich at Midroll and Earwolf and you talked to him. What were you trying to figure out? And then what did all those conversations and searching lead you to?
Well, I was just trying to figure out, like, so to me, it just felt like, okay, here's this thing that feels like it can be big. It feels to me and to the people, to the listeners are enthusiastic about it. Their numbers are growing. They're so excited about podcasting that they will drop, you know, money on a t-shirt like that. And also the other thing about that was Planet Money had grown out of This American Life. So This American Life started as this sort of like storytelling, sort of like telling these quirky stories about people and human drama and feelings. And then we'd sort of taken some of those same tools and started and used it to tell stories about finance and economics. And that worked too. And then I thought, well, look, we can just keep doing this. We can do, you know, sort of like these kinds of stories about technology. We can do these kinds of stories about cars. We can do these kinds of stories about relationships. You know, we can do, there's the world is big here. And I'm sitting in the middle of it right now, which is the public radio system. So like, let's make a fund or something that can sort of bankroll some of these initiatives.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was calling around to Jeff and I was calling around to Roman, it was questions of like, how do you guys finance it? Because these were people who were doing it independently. And so what I was trying to figure out from them is like, okay, how are you guys making it work? And the thing that was, so Roman Mars does a podcast called 99% Invisible. I'd known him because we'd sort of traveled in the same public radio circles, but he had gone off on his own and started this podcast called 99% Invisible. And I was listening, I was a listener to it and still am, and a fan. And he would keep on referencing like staff people. And I was like, you're an independent dude doing a podcast and you have a staff now? And he had sponsors. And so I was like, what's going on here? And like, as I started to talk to him and he sort of explained to me the finances and like his audience and like what growth was looking like, I was like, oh, this can be, you're doing this on your own. You have a staff of 3 or 4 people. You're bringing in like, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, just like as an independent guy doing this. Imagine if we sort of like tried to bring, you know, sort of make it official, you know, what could be done. So that was sort of inspiring to me. And then of course, Jeff started Midroll and started Earwolf, you know, on his own with his own money, you know, just like out of his apartment one day, you know, classic startup story.
Yeah.
And they were both so amped to be talking to me about it. Cause it felt like we were all discovering this thing. In the beginning, it felt like we were all really, really excited. We had the secret, like this thing can be huge, and we're in on the beginning of it. And like we were all like, just pumped to talk to each other about it.
And Midroll sells advertising, and Earwolf creates content. And you told, I think it was you and Matt Lieber on an episode of HubSpot, you said, you know what? I didn't realize at the time that I didn't need to go after venture capitalist. I'm wondering, why did you go after VC money and instead of following in the paths of the two men you talked about? And who else should you have gone after then?
So I've thought about this a lot. Like, so part of it is just like my profound naivete and how any of this worked in the beginning. Like, I did not know the difference between investors of any. I didn't know that investors came in categories. Like, I wouldn't have known the difference between, you know, an average, you know, sort of like retired person who wants to invest in like, you know, $10,000 in a restaurant and a venture capitalist like would work at Kleiner Perkins. I didn't know the difference between any of those people. They were all the same. They were all like vaguely rich people who had money to invest in things. And so I just happened through my job to have connections to Chris Sacca because I'd interviewed him for another series of stories that I worked on, and I knew that he was a fan of This American Life. And so I was like, oh, well, you're a fan of This American Life. Obviously, you'll invest in me, right? Like that, it just seemed like that was that straightforward and that naive. So now knowing what I know, I understand that venture capitalists are looking for a certain type of profile. From, you know, they're looking for high growth, very, they're looking for the companies that have the potential to become massive quickly. And I don't think media companies necessarily, unless you're a technology play or a platform play, they don't follow the same trajectory.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but in that first season, you did say Chris Sacco was trying to direct you to create a platform. I'm wondering then, were you the wrong kind of investment for him, but he did it because, as you said before, it's not that much money for him and he's a fan?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. And I don't know, like, I don't think Chris, you know, I don't think Chris could, well, I don't know. Like, and I've asked him about it and he was like, no, I feel like I believed in you. You had this thing. It wasn't very much money. It was just a very small amount of money. Chris also, and like any investor who raises money from LPs, can't say exactly his exact opinion because he has fiduciary duties to people.
It would be kind of insulting if he said, hey, you know what? I just kind of like your show. You're not really an entrepreneur, but I like it.
I wouldn't even be insulted by that necessarily, because I feel like I wouldn't take we are going to become a very large company. We're going to become a very successful company.
You already are, from what I hear, 60 people?
Yeah. And we're bringing
how much revenue?
We brought in $7 million in revenue last year. We're hoping to do significantly more than that this year. So we're on track. Like, I don't have any doubt, we're going to be very, very large, very successful. But I don't think we're I don't think we're going to be Uber. You know what I mean? Like, that's, and if what you're looking for is building a bunch of companies that could be Uber, then we're not the person that you're.
So who would have been the right investor for you now that you know, and you've really gotten in there? You've got Andrew Mason from Groupon as an investor, Marco Arment as an investor. So you've got like the whole range of people here. Who would be the ideal for the company your size?
Well, so I think the people with like so I think the right investor for us are those people that you named. I mean, the people, like when we interviewed Andrew Mason about it, he was like, I asked him, why are you investing in us? And he was like, I'm investing in you guys the sort of the way I'd invest in somebody who opens a restaurant. Like, I'll get to have a relationship with you and I'll see.
Yeah.
And I think that's one example. There are strategic investors, people who are interested in media, who are interested in building media businesses, who would want to invest in us because we're doing something interesting, we're innovating in the space, and we have an expertise in a domain, audio, that other people are now looking to enter. I think there are people who are interested from a mission perspective. They just want good audio. They like the product, and so they invest for that reason. I think a lot of investment happens for that, even though people don't admit it. Like, a lot of it is like, I have this need, so I like what you're doing, and therefore I will invest in you. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people invested in us for the same reason. If you're into podcasts and you think podcasts are going to get bigger than they are today, we're pretty good. We're maybe the best investment out there. You know, I mean, we're one of the few companies that's really doing it, that is able to take investment at the level that people want to put in. When we did our Series B, when we did our Series A, the group that led that was Graham Holdings, which the CEO is Tim O'Shaughnessy, and they're interested because, you know, it fits their long-term strategic initiatives, right? Like, so they have a much longer time horizon, and so they want us to just build value, and they're not looking for like a quick exit. They're not looking for 5 years. We want to sell or go public.
Okay.
And so people with that, we're a really good bet. Like, we are going to be building lots of value over the long term, and like, we're a great investment for them.
Your flagship podcast is the startup podcast that I mentioned that I was turned on to.
Yeah.
I heard you say at the XOXO conference, it was a publicity stunt. It seems like you didn't mean for it to be the flagship. It was just going to be what?
Oh, so I had this problem, right? I was about to leave these two very well-established, very legacy media organizations that were at the top of their game, that had millions and millions of listeners. And I was about to embark on my own, and I had no audience of my own, right? I had to start my Twitter account right before I left. Like, I didn't even have any Twitter followers. I didn't have anything. You know, I wasn't active on Facebook. I was in no way equipped like a lot of people today that are just born sort of like with social media native, they have bigger audiences than I had as like, you know, somebody who'd been sort of like, a practitioner with these other legacy media organizations. So I was, I knew I was like, okay, well, I'm going to have a podcasting company. I need some kind of audience to give that podcast, you know, I need some kind of audience. What am I going to do to get an audience? I need to do something to bring attention to myself.
I see.
And the only thing I had going on was that I was starting this company. And so I figured like, well, I'll take people inside that. And I really did think it would be like interesting. I'll record some interviews with like investors. It'll be a cool behind the scenes peek at like what this actually looks like. But you know, Chris Sock is such great tape. And like what was actually happening was like a lot more emotionally raw than I thought it would be. And I was like, oh wait, this is an actual story. This is real. And like I'm documenting something that is like both very specific, but also sort of universal. Like it's something that happens over and over again.
Right.
And that's sort of the hallmark of a good story, something that has like unique, interesting specifics, but also has like these universal elements. And so as I realized that, I was like, oh, wait, maybe there's something more here than just a publicity stunt.
Okay. Speaking of the hallmark of a good story, we've talked about so far, you're going from heights to heights to heights. You keep doing well. One of the hallmarks is a pain that would make us want to root for you, struggle,
yes.
Right? So as a guy with a long-term job, with real job security, as much as you could get, leaving your work, what did it feel like? Did you wake up in the middle of the night with fears the way that I always seem to? I mean, not so much anymore, but I do. Did you wake up with that?
Of course I did.
What was it like for you? For me, it's my family's going to be in a box and everyone who's listening to me is going to say, you're such a fool. You thought you were going to teach us from these interviews? You couldn't even get yourself out of a box.
Yeah.
What was it for you?
I think it was that. It was like, am I making a horrible mistake? Do I know, am I equipped to do the thing that I'm saying that I want to, that I say I want to do? Will I be able to pull it off? Am I just a fool and filled with hubris?
Can you take me through one time? Like I've heard you say in Creative Live, good stories are when you ask about one incident, one moment. Was there one moment where you were really afraid in the beginning where it was shocking?
Yeah. I mean,
tell me about it.
You know, I talked about this a little bit on Startup, but I remember like sort of like the first time after coming back from my first interview, my first sort of like meeting with Chris Sacca, and it was after the second meeting. So I'd gone out to meet Chris Sacca, and he gave me what I now recognize as sort of like the VC brush off, which is like, this is a really cool idea. I'm not ready to invest right now, but come back out and once you've done this and this and this and see us. And so so I'd come back out and I'd met his partner Matt Mazzeo, and I had this sort of naive, like I'd had pretty much success at that point. So I had won some awards in public radio, and I was like, I was running Planet Money. So I was sort of at the top of my career in that world. And I felt like a little bit of a big deal. And then I got out there and I was talking to Matt Mazzeo, and they're thinking like what they're comparing you to is like, you know, huge company, like multi-billion-dollar company. They're looking for like the next Twitter, the next Uber. They're working with like kids who come out of Stanford who are like geniuses, like, fluent in seven languages, perfect SAT.
Who don't have like so much gray hair, let's be honest.
Don't, you know, young, like, or just like, and all of a sudden I was like, I realized like, oh, this is now the sort of like, these are the people that I'm competing against. I'm competing against the best and the brightest of the entire world. And I'm going to be compared to like the Mark Zuckerbergs and the Bill Gateses and the Steve Jobs of the world. And I'm not worthy at all. Like I am not like that. And it just felt like, wow, that is a really, I've now entered like a whole different league, and I'm in no way prepared to sort of be sort of like, you know, sort of like doing battle there. And it was just like a really humbling, and just, I just remember thinking like, why did I do this? Like what was I possibly thinking? There's no way that's going to
work. And were you already out of NPR at that point?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'd already quit. And, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And then you actually ended up growing your audience bigger than you expected, more revenue than you expected. And we'll talk about how you did that, especially the audience part I'm curious about. But first, I'm going to do an ad. And now, Alex, I like the way that you guys redid the ads on your show. You actually went and talked to the guests. You had a story within the ad. And I think Matt even said that people have asked you to actually have a podcast of nothing but the ads, which ordinarily I would think was BS, but I get it. True. It's good storytelling. So give me especially the negative. I don't even want the positive. I can congratulate myself on my own. The negative of how I'm about to do this ad. Here's the ad. It's for a company called Design Crowd. And anyone who's listening to me knows that for a long time, my iTunes presence was really ugly. It was this black and white photo that someone took in my office. They turned it black and white, which, Alex, really means the photo was ugly. And if they turn it black and white, it could look a little classy. So ugly classy is better than ugly ugly. And so we had that, and then we put my logo on it, which who cares? Mixergy logo? Why would anyone subscribe just because of the logo? And startup stories underneath it, because I thought people care about startup. Anyway, the whole thing was a mess. For years that went on, and I never touched it because I was secretly afraid. I'm afraid of design. I could logic my way through stories. If you're listening to this podcast at all, Alex, you can kind of see how I'm using the mechanics of storytelling to start off. But without like logic and mechanics, I don't even know how to make something look good. So I stayed away from it before. And then even when Design Crowd did my first run of ads, Alex, I'm so embarrassed to say this. I ran the ads for them because I know that they'd help my friends, but I never used it myself because I was too afraid to use it. And they said, look, Andrew, we're going to give you a free account. Go use it. Do whatever you want. And I still couldn't use it even though I had this need. Then one night my wife was out of town. And I had nothing else to do. And so I went to just check out Design Crowd. And I paid, like within like that one box, I tell them what I'm looking for. And it turns out I had opinions because I liked, like I specifically used you guys. I said, look, Gimlet has a small logo. I don't need a big logo. Make the point big. Make my picture clear. So I told them that I had opinions in a box. I hit submit. They said, take out your credit card. I said, you know, these guys will do it for free, but it's nothing. $200. I put in my credit card. Boom. I bought it. The next Monday, I forgot about it. I got into work. Boom, I get dozens of designs from dozens, literally dozens of designers. I ended up picking the perfect one for me. And now if you look at iTunes right now, if you're listening to me, there's a brand new design today because of them. I'm so proud of the design. I never asked them to pay for it because it costs hardly anything. And if you're listening to me, you can use the same discount code I used. Just go to designcrowd.com/Mixergy. They're going to give you up to $100 off your custom design. It's not just me. Anyone can get dozens of designs from dozens of different creatives, and they will follow your direction to create something that's perfect for you. 100% money back guarantee. If it's not right, you let them know. designcrowd.com/Mixergy.
All right.
Only the negative.
The negative?
Yes.
It's hard to say. Like that was, that's good. That's a compelling ad. Like you put yourself in it. I think one of the reasons that ads on podcasts work is that you know, you can tell when somebody, we have a relationship with the host, like listener has a relationship with the host. And so if you're telling something and you're excited about it, like we can feel that. And so I think in that sense, I think it was a really compelling, you know, personal narrative that you gave. I was sold. It actually compelled me to go and look at your
the
logo. Is that the one with you punching forward?
Yes.
Yeah, it's good.
Thanks.
It's like Pops, the yellow background. Yeah. Negative. What would I say about the negative from a storytelling perspective? Nothing. Just a couple minor. If you edited this podcast, I would edit out a couple minor, like sort of like a couple things where like there were asides that sort of like didn't add to the story, but sort of slowed it down.
So you know what, Alex? I'm glad you brought that up. Here's my problem with storytelling. I used to work for Dale Carnegie, and they're all about teaching storytellers to people who are in business not telling stories.
Yeah.
And I remember learning why storytelling will actually convince people. But the challenge I always had with it is I feel like business people, like my audience, just want to get to the point. And so in my head, as I'm telling a story, I know you're gonna remember it better through my story. You're going to trust it because of my story. But I'm also taking up your time. And so I can't get that I'm taking up their time worry out of my head. What do you do about that?
Well, I think that I have that worry too. And I think that's what makes a good storyteller is that like you're always holding two things. You want to get things across. You have information that you are burning to tell somebody, but you also are aware that the other person might not give a shit about what you're saying. Can we put this on your podcast? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. So you want to hold those two things both in your mind. And I think we have the luxury of being able to edit this stuff out so we can go long and then cut it down later.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's what makes a great storyteller, is knowing that like a compelling detail will sell the story, but also knowing that too many compelling details like muddy the story. And so you gotta find that line. And that's what a great story always is like finding the line between the right amount of detail, too many details, too few details. Too few details, there's nothing to hold on to. Too many, and like you've drowned people in information.
It takes forever. And you know what? I have to be honest with you. I told you before we started, if you give out a number like what your revenue is and you want me to edit it out later, I'm not doing it. And I say that as a point of pride because I want the audience to know you're going to get stuff that you're not supposed to get. People right. sometimes will just spill things by accident, and that's what makes Mixergy so interesting. But I'll be honest with you, Alex. Part of my reason for doing it is I don't even know the first thing about editing, and I didn't even know what it would cost to edit. And so I thought I'm going to use my weakness, lack of editing, as a strength. So let me ask you, as a guy who sees editing as a strength of your work, what does it cost? How much time does it take to, say, take an interview like this and edit it down to your – to your criteria?
I mean, it can take as little or as much time as you want. Like the way we do really, really time consuming, expensive edited podcasts. I mean, that's sort of what we do. And some of them are more time consuming than others. And like sometimes we layer in music and we'll go through some podcasts, some episodes, we'll go through like, I don't know, 49, 50 revisions. You know, and it's just sort of like it's super fine tuning, rough cuts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Some podcasts, it'll be like, you know, there's an average of two or three edits and then it's out the door. At its simplest version, it's simply finding an audio program. They're super simple. You can get like, you know, you can get a bunch of them. And it's almost like cutting and pasting in Microsoft Word. You just like, but instead of the words,
But it takes so much longer to listen. You've said, actually, one of the things that I do well is I speed edit, or I edit fast. How do you do that? If you have a 30-minute show, how do you take, and you're going over it dozens of times, how do you not have it take dozens of times 30 minutes?
No, I mean, that's what it is. And it's like it's sort of real time. Yeah, I mean, like there's no way to do, like the minute you commit to an edit, you've committed to at least probably tripling your time commitment to the project that you're doing. Mm-hmm. Like you can't, your podcast is going to take as long to produce as it is for us to have our conversation. Essentially, you got to press a couple buttons at the beginning, press a couple buttons at the end. And like the great thing about that is that you can have a great, great product depending on the strength of our conversation. If we have a great conversation and people like it, like they're listening to something that's like, you know, approaching as good as like anything
right
in audio. The hard thing about that is that it's hard to like, there's always going to be something that could be a little bit better if you take it out. But what I always say is like, once you've committed to the kind of stories that we do, the edited stories, then you've automatically, just the minute you set foot into the editing pool, you have set the bar so much higher, to mix my metaphors. But you have just like,
I get it.
You know what I mean? You've now committed to doing something that is like much better, because a pretty good real-time interview is way better than a poorly executed.
What does it cost to hire a good editor? I'm getting a little too in the weeds, and I promise my audience, if you're listening, we're going to get into how he markets his stuff, considering that he's not a marketer. It's really interesting, and about sales and so much more that's business related. What does it cost to hire a good editor?
I will answer that question in 1 second, and we're real time, so this is a real live thing. Hey Kevin, I left my power cord.
Oh, that's so interesting. I saw you look over.
I just realized I have 9% of my battery, I think. Is there, there's one up at my desk. It's probably one outside. I just need to grab one. I just want to make sure that there's not one here.
Sorry. I might need to. Yeah. So what do you want? What computer are you on right now?
I'm on a Mac.
Okay.
A Mac laptop. What does it cost to hire a good editor? That is a really good question.
I just might have lost you. Like, so, one of the powers of editing. Somebody who just knows
Pro Tools and knows how to edit in Pro Tools, it doesn't, you know, it's like, you know, you can get somebody with those skills for like 50.
Sorry, we totally lost you until just now. What were you saying cost?
Sorry, I was saying it's a complicated question. What does it cost to get somebody who knows how to operate Pro Tools and knows how the technical of
no,
editing
the
sound?
Actual, the content.
The content, man, that is like, I don't know, you're definitely six figures, if not, you know, mid, you know, like that's, it's like, it's, it, it, they cost, they're in demand, you know. We're trying to hire people who have a lot of experience producing high quality audio content. That is like, they're rare. They're very rare. And they're in high demand now because lots and lots of people are coming into this.
Yeah, because even in terrestrial radio, they don't have that. It's only NPR that I know of that does that kind of storytelling and editing.
Yeah, because for so long, it didn't make any economic sense to get good at it. Like, there was no reason. I used to teach a narrative. I used to teach a documentary radio journalism class at Columbia University. I was the professor. My class was always oversubscribed because I was working at This American Life, and This American Life is a popular program. So people were super psyched about This American Life. They would sign up for my class. I would teach them. I loved it. But I always felt like I should apologize to them afterwards. This was in the early 2000s because I was like, guys, there's no jobs here for you. Like, you are, I'm teaching you the least marketable skill in the world right now, how to get really good at narrative audio editing. And now it's, you know, here we are in 2017, the world has turned upside down. Like, I couldn't hire enough of those people fast enough. In fact, many of the people that I used to teach in my Columbia course now work at Gimlet.
I remember talking to the CTO of Yelp, and he said that when he gets together with his developers, he uses storytelling as a way of communicating with them because it's actually going to get them to remember what he says and to believe enough in it that they're going to go out and execute, right? I used to think, hey, if you're the boss, people are just going to execute. He showed me, no, you actually need to persuade them, and storytelling is a good way to do it. What's your advice for someone like that who's just trying to communicate and persuade, not create a podcast? What do they need to know about storytelling to do that?
I think they need to know, I think you want to be, you want to find a way to connect. Storytelling is about connecting. And so what you need to be is you need to be vulnerable a little bit. You need to be able to show your own sort of weakness, your own sense of confusion. You need to be putting yourself in peril in the story that you're telling, mm-hmm. and then hopefully getting yourself out of peril with the moral of your story. But like, you need to be connecting on that authentic human level with your stories. And I think that's where people trust you. People don't trust somebody they can't fully see as a vulnerable human being. And I think if you can, you don't want to be weak, but you want to be human. And I think that's where storytelling can really help. If you can tell something that's authentic and feels like it lays out a vision and connects with people on a human level, people will be very drawn to that.
That's something that entrepreneurs that I interview don't accept easily. I have to tell them, look, please, you have to give people a challenge that you wrestled with, or else no one's going to root for you. You're going to look like some asshole who always had everything go well for him, or a liar, right?
Yeah.
So what do you do to get people to be vulnerable?
Well, I mean, I mean, we're in the business of like, we can sometimes pick and choose. We audition people who, like, that's one of the things that I developed early on in my career, was sort of like, oh yeah, like, you're a good talker, you're not a good talker. And often what that means,
but that's your on-air talent. What about when you're interviewing, and a lot of your shows are based on other people's personalities, right? You're going out and you're interviewing them and bringing back clips.
Oh yeah, but sometimes we'll audition people. We won't go out and interview somebody. We pre-interview people a lot of times. And if somebody is like a bad pre-interview, we won't go out and interview them on tape. You know, they have to have that, like, that tendency towards sort of like, you can hear it. You can hear like an emotional presence in somebody mm-hmm. who's going to be a good interview. And it's like somebody who's like, they're just emotionally aware, you know, and that's what I'm always looking for. I don't know. Like, it's the way I am. It's obviously the way you are. I don't know if it's a prerequisite for success. Like, certainly there are successful CEOs who are not vulnerable and are not emotive and are not, like, you know, like, sort of like gesticulating emotional beings like you and me. I don't, you know what I mean? So like, I don't want to say that everybody needs to be like me or like you in order to like form a connection.
No, but if they
want to
tell compelling stories that people care and remember, then they need to do that. Even if it's just like, look, I got to put on a show, so I'm going to exaggerate my own vulnerability as a way of having people connect with me. Right.
Yeah. But it's true. And the people that I have met who are in positions of like leadership, they all do have that something. They have that like ability to connect and the ability to sort of be relatable, even if they are pretty special.
I like that you broke down what you thought made for a good podcast. You said companionship, action, right? Something useful, something people could use, or a good narrative. Two out of three, you've got a winning combination. You need at least one. Am I right?
Yeah. And well, I was like, companionship, a good, you know, narrative. And then also I think edification is sort of the way I think about it, which is sort of like learning something. I want to learn something from the podcast. And so I think that's a big use case for podcasts, is like, because podcasting is one of the few things that you can do while you're doing something else. It's sort of designed for our multitasking world right now. And so And so I think a lot of people want to be like, what, how can I make my commute more productive? Oh, I can listen to this podcast where I learn about business, or I can listen to this podcast where I learn about like literature or whatever. And so that's one of the buckets is learning. So narrative, companionship, and learning, I think, are the three big buckets.
And companionship is that part where, when I was listening to Howard Stern growing up, feel free to get that charger if you need it. Yeah. I was listening to Howard Stern growing up, and they would tell a story about their lives, what happened with their wives, what happened with their boyfriends.
Oh, my
and you're
God.
Kind of feeling like you're part of the
divorce.
Family, and you keep having that in the background, right?
Remember him when he was going through his divorce?
Yes, I remember him when he was in his marriage, when he and his wife would argue about tuna fish cans, and that made me feel like, I get him, I'm connected, let's see what happens.
He's a genius at what we do. I mean, he is just like so good at connecting emotionally in so many ways and getting super honest, vulnerable moments out of anybody. Sorry, I got caught in my Howard Stern reverie. What was the question again?
No, that was just a point. Yeah. It was a statement. Yeah. There was nothing beyond that little reminiscing. I always admired that Ira Glass at This American Life, when Howard Stern was the most attacked, came out and said, I'm a listener. And actually, it's good to have this kind of stuff out there. And for you to have cursed on the show and in other things that I've heard, I thought was kind of interesting. Because I think I used to imagine that you guys were just a bunch of reading nerds who would shush people who were making too much noise while you were reading to prepare for something.
And our cardigans with our leather elbow patches. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I know. No, we curse. We listen to Howard Stern. We're no different than the rest of you.
All right, I'll talk about my second sponsor, and then I want to get into how you actually promoted this thing, because you now had a podcast that you had to promote and then many others that you grew. All right, the second sponsor is a company called TopTal, and I never thought that I was actually the right company for TopTal, because I know that they talk about hiring the best of the best, and all I had was a WordPress site. And the thing about having a WordPress site is there's a plugin for everything, I thought. There was always something I needed that I couldn't find a plugin for. And so I finally said, hey, TopTal, I know you guys have the best of the best. Can I hire one of your people? And they said, yeah. I said, you know, I'm on WordPress. They said, dude, we work with WordPress. We work with anything. We got developers here all over the world. All we care about is that they're the best of the best. We're snobs about that, but the rest we're not snobbish about. Use WordPress, use your own homemade site, whatever it is. So I went to TopTal and I hired them. And man, this guy, the first guy they sent me was good, but we didn't click. They replaced him, got me a second person. That guy, we clicked, and he was so good. We were budgeting 2 to 3 weeks for the thing to be done. He redid our whole search in a matter of days, less than a week. I said, this is it? He goes, yeah, here it is. Take it. Go do whatever you want with it. Unbelievably fast. I've had people here, if you've listened to me for any period of time, you know, they've come in for scotch night and they've thanked me. They bought bottles of scotches to say, Andrew, thanks for introducing me to TopTal, because they hired one person, a team of developers. Sometimes just their whole company is basically run by TopTal developers. So if you're looking to hire great developers and you want the best of the best, people who are snobbish about that but open to everything else, you really have got to check out TopTal. And because TopTal is not just one of the, I think they're one of the unicorns here, one of the billion-dollar companies. They're also created by a Mixergy fan. He is giving us 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours, and that's in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. Even Google doesn't hire people with a no-risk trial period. They commit. Here you get no-risk trial period, and TopTal will take care of you because they're fans of Mixergy like you are. All you have to do is go to the special URL. It's toptal.com/Mixergy. Top. As in top of the mountain, tal as in talent, toptal.com/Mixergy. And because Alex said, look, if you're listening to me and you're following along with these sponsors, it's because you care about me and you believe in me. I'm going to tell you guys, here's my email address. If you want an intro to Nelson, the guy who I know, who I get together with for ramen here in San Francisco, I'd be happy to make an introduction. Just email me, andrew@Mixergy.com. You don't have to write it down. You'll remember it. andrew@Mixergy.com. And I'll be happy to introduce you to my sponsor, TopTal. That was a nice touch. This is why I like video. I saw you smile at that and I said, that's good. I'm on the right track. It must be so hard for you guys not to do video with all your guests.
Oh no, it's not hard for me at all. I am scared by video and I prefer the anonymity of audio.
Is that why your mic is so big that half the time I see just eyeglasses?
Exactly. These are not mics that are made for video. These are audio only.
But audio is more important. That's a thing, actually. Audio now has become more important than video. That's why I'm not showing the video as much. I'm emphasizing the podcast.
By the way, do you say that?
You know what? I used to think that video, and it was, video was the number one way that people consume Mixergy. They used to really connect with me on video. They used to watch along with me. And then I realized the video was becoming a hindrance because people assumed I only did video, and they were shifting towards just podcasting, and so they didn't think of me as a podcast option. Mm-hmm. So we hid the video, only made it available to people who want it. Largely, I use the video to get a sense of the guest. And also, who knows, maybe in 3 years, it'll all shift again. But right. I'm emphasizing the podcast because podcast subscribers are more valuable. Podcast subscribers connect with you on an ongoing basis. And people are looking for podcasts. They're not necessarily looking for more video.
Right.
Not right. independent anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's talk about this thing of how you grew your freaking audience so big. You kept like going to the top of the charts. Right. What yeah. You guys even had like one episode of like Reply All. The guy said, all right, that's all we have. We have no show. We tried calling someone. We couldn't get him on the phone. That's it. We're leaving. And even that got to the top of the charts. I'm wondering, what do you guys do for promotion, Alex? Don't act above promotion. You're an entrepreneur now. You're not an NPR guy. What do you do?
We don't do any we don't do any paid marketing or anything like that. We haven't done any paid advertising at all. Everything, all our growth has been organic. And the main thing we do is what I'm doing right now. The best way to grow your podcast audience is to put yourself and your programs in front of other people who are already listening to podcasts. And together we podcasters are growing this audience. And initially I was able I was able to use my connections in my old world and my old colleagues and friends from public radio. And the first big break was like the first episode of Startup, where I played it for my old boss, Ira Glass, mainly just sort of like, hey, I'm doing this. Can you give me some, I'd love your ears on this. You know, like you're one of the greatest editors in the business. Like, what do you think? Like, do I have anything here? And he listened to it. And this was right after I'd left my job there, but I was just still very, very close with everybody, as I am still today. And he really liked it. And he said, oh, this would be good. In fact, I would be interested in putting this on This American Life. And so I was like, that's great. And so the first episode of Startup ran on This American Life, which of course has a pretty massive audience. And so that got us our first, 50,000 listeners.
50,000 subscribers.
Subscribers, yeah.
And the reason you could tell they're subscribers, I've heard you use the word subscribers multiple times, but there's no real way to tell. What you can tell is on an ongoing basis, we can count on about 50,000 downloads per episode. Is that how you're doing it?
We look at, like, we just see how many downloads we get per episode. So I don't know if it's, I didn't use the word subscribers, actually. I would say listeners. I don't know. Some of them are subscribing through iTunes. Some of them are just listening, on various of the other platforms. But like,
I see.
From my perspective, they're all like, we just get counts of, who listened.
Got it. Okay.
And so we assume the majority of them are subscribers, like somewhere it used to be probably in the 75-80%. I think now it's closer in the 60-65% are probably listening through iTunes on their iPhones. So that got us our first 50,000 basically. And then from there, it was just organic. Like people used to say that podcasting doesn't go viral. It does. It just doesn't go viral as quickly as a video, because a video you can consume in 10 seconds. And so you can consume it and share it with 10 people and it takes 10 seconds and then they'd share it and that takes 10 seconds. And if you do the math, it's sort of like 10 seconds plus multiple shares, 10 seconds plus multiple shares, things can go viral in a day. A podcast, you have to listen for half an hour and then share it with 10 friends. And they have to listen for half an hour and share it for 10 friends. So if you do
the
math. Which
is what's going to keep you from even telling 10 friends. Because I feel like if I'm going to tell somebody else about a podcast, I'm basically inflicting a 30-minute homework assignment on them. So it better be really good.
Yeah. It's harder to share.
Yeah.
And then the time between consuming the content and sharing is longer.
Right.
And so what that leads to, so you're sharing it with fewer people and each of those people has a longer lag time before they share it with their fewer people. So things don't go viral the same way. They still go viral. It just happens over a longer period of time.
I feel like it's more word of mouth than virality. Word of mouth is I have a really nice sandwich.
Well, it depends on what you mean by viral. Like it depends on it doesn't go viral immediately. Like it doesn't happen like a video. But,
what else did you do then?
What did I do? So that was our main thing. Once I continued to go on other podcasts. I went on all, lots and lots of other entrepreneurial podcasts. I did, we had an episode featured on Planet Money. And so that, all those things sort of grew the initial audience of Startup. And then from that, we were able to launch Reply All. Reply All did the same thing. They're very socially, active. They, and so they were posting on Dig for a long time in the beginning. So they had like sort of like a companion piece, like a written piece that they would do. And all these things are little, like none of them have huge bumps, but like all of it adds up. And then we grew our, and then at a certain point we had a pretty big network of our own. Then we can launch from that network. And so, and so then you can launch from, you know, like once you have, you know, Startup and Reply All, you can launch a Crime Town, and then Crime Town goes and finds some of its own audience, and then you can sort of promote back to Reply All, and like it becomes a nice reinforcing cycle. But mainly that's what we've been doing. We've been finding ways to get in front of other listening audiences, either on the radio or on podcast. And we've been trying to make compelling content.
I could have just had you on here because you were promoting. You know, I paid $1,000 to the booker who could nail, who could like nail, who could get me your interview. I didn't realize it was that easy. that's truth.
Yeah.
You know what? You mentioned that thing about Dig. I saw that. I'm a heavy Dig reader. It's one of my favorite sites because they really curate interesting articles that I wouldn't consider otherwise. And Reply All used to do these long form text based articles on there. Why did you guys stop? What was the result of that?
I think I don't know. I haven't talked to them about that. Like why they stopped. I think I think it was just a matter of like resources. You know, sort of like how much time do they have to write those articles versus how much time do they have to devote to the podcast? They have been. Another thing that we found, and especially from Reply All, is that consistency also helps. Consistency helps build your audience.
And consistent publishing.
Consistent publishing.
Yeah.
And that's been one of the hallmarks of Reply All over the years. Like they've 10x their audience since we started. You know, and a lot of that has been, you know, sort of doing these things like trying to get there. They've had pieces on This American Life, they've had pieces on Radiolab, they have friends in the business that they've been able to sort of like do the kind of content that those shows want to carry. Also they're pretty regular. They publish on a pretty regular basis. They're there for their listener almost every week, and so that that helps.
That was one of the ballsiest thing that I've seen you do. The guys who created Reply All, I forget the show that they had, but it was, I'm a long-term listener of On the Media. And they used to have this quirky show on the Media that I used to love. And I said, how does this even get on the Media's podcast? And then you hired them. And I don't even know how to describe them to tell my audience, this is one of the podcasts that I listen to on a regular basis. I can't stop. And I don't even know why to tell them to listen. To say it's an internet show, which is what they say, it doesn't do it justice. They'll go talk to a quirky guy who was on like on Napster or something years ago. And I'll follow along.
Yeah. No, they're great. They're incredible. And they do a lot of that stuff. Like they have the companionship. Like you just want to hang out with them. They're really fun to hang out with. They're great on mic. Mm-hmm. And they are great storytellers. And like they will take you on a journey and you're going to go along with them because they take great care to like make it fun and unexpected and like have sort of things revealed. And you're along for the ride with them. They're just
That's kind of a gut instinct thing. And you said in another, I forget where I was researching, you said, look, up until now, it's all been gut. I know what I feel is going to do well or I think is going to do well. That's how I hired. Now I've got a system. And then this is where the bad connections in these podcasts stink. The connection got jarbled as you explaining what your new process was. I go, wait, I keep hitting 15-second rewind. I don't know. What is? How do you do this? What's the next process?
The process of like how we how we
figure
decide.
Out what the next shows are that are worth investing in because you guys invest a lot of money and never mind time also.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that we're still working out. And that's been one of the big, you know, and I think I haven't been, you know, I haven't made a secret about like the challenges of sort of like that I've found of, you know, sort of like transitioning from my old world as like a pure content creator to my new role as like as the head of a company. And I'm no longer making the stuff. I'm the one who has to create the conditions where the stuff gets made. And a lot of what that means is putting processes in place. And I'm still working it out. Like we've gotten really good at launching shows. But as we get bigger and as we continue to expand into new areas, we still have to work out like what is our process. And part of it is always going to be some element of art, but we're still trying to figure out what the science is. And
what have you documented so far? I'm curious about documenting and putting a process behind art.
Yeah. So I mean, obviously you look at like listens, you know, that's one of the base, you know, the basic, like, is it like on a basic level, is it connecting with an audience or not? And you can see that, you know, you can see it pretty wide away. You see what kind of feedback you get on different shows. And so some shows get, you know, they just feel buzzier. Just you get this feedback from social media and everything. And you can tell like, oh, that's connecting in a way that some other show isn't. We have a survey that we do. We have our members, and we give early access to shows that we're piloting to our members. And we'll ask them to give us. We'll ask them to sort of like rate the experience of listening to this early episode. And what we're, and like, that's not like mostly. These are sort of like very, very committed Gimlet fans, and so like. They're generally pretty positive. They're probably more positive right. about anything than like your average sort of person on the street would be. But still, there's good learning to be gotten from like
Alex,
what
they were.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I keep interrupting because I got so little time with you and I want to get so much in here. And part of the reason I have to interrupt is your shows, you spend so much money on them. Like Crime Town, is not a show where you can just put this whole thing together and you know what? The audience tells us it's not good. Let's just scrap it. Right? We're talking about crime in it's Rhode Island, right? Over a series of weeks, you're telling this story, deep investigation, right? So, how do you know ahead of time? Is there a way to know ahead of time?
Well, there isn't. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, that's where you have to like trust, sort of like your instincts. You have to trust the talent of the people that you're working with. There are people who are good at doing this. There are people who have gotten good at telling compelling stories, holding people's attention. And if we can continue to work with those people and we can continue to foster the skills and the people that we're working with, that's part of what we're doing.
It's interesting how you said, now I'm creating the process or the environment to help people run this business. I'm wondering, what kind of systems have you put in place? What kind of processes already exist in a company that's about 2-3 years old now?
We have a big part of it for us was building out the organization. So we have a key role here as editor. And so that's the person who's got like a lot of experience, a lot of depth of experience in audio. And they have both an editorial role across shows and also a management role. And so there's like a big emotional component to making something, you know, I guess to making art, to making craft, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Like it's scary. It's like this weird the people who work it are like sort of creative types. And so it needs a deft hand of sort of like helping to guide those people and manage them. And so we put a lot of effort into finding the right managers, the right people who can sort of lead these processes. And that's mm-hmm. a big part of what we do. We're in terms of like, I can't reveal all our secrets about how all the processes we use, but like we are, a lot of this year is going to be about really formalizing like how that looks. Like we have
like, not all of it, but like you said, people come into these things to learn, and there are a lot of entrepreneurs who've been doing things by gut, frankly me for a long time, who want to put more systems in place. What's one system you put in place that you're as proud of as maybe an episode of one of your shows?
I think what's a system? I know there's an answer to this question. I'm just thinking like what it is. I mean, I think we've gotten pretty good at like making, like, you know, at taking something from like, here's an idea, and then, okay, let's prototype that idea, you know? And so we'll put a couple producers and we'll just go out and try to do like a small version of this idea and like then take it back and listen to it and look at it and try to figure it out. And like we've done that on almost every show that we've launched. We've made the prototype. And we'll share that pretty widely. We'll share that with the staff. We'll share it with our members and sometimes. And like once you've shared it with people, and it's not so much about getting the feedback as watching them. Like when you were watching me listen to your ad, it's a lot of that. Like you can see mm-hmm. where people respond, where they don't. You can see where something that you thought was working is falling flat. And so the prototyping process is something that we have like now set in stone, and that's a big part of what we're doing. That's something that works. Yeah.
So the host of Heavyweight might call up his dad and say, "Do you want to talk to your brother?" And then see that his brother's feeling a little awkward, or that his dad's feeling a little awkward, and you record that and play it for people.
Or with that, like what we did is we went out before we launched that show. We went out with Jonathan and we did like a couple of like, here's what the show might be, and we did a version of that, and we tried to make it pretty quick, and we put it together. But like he wrote a script, and we cut the tape together, and we like threw it together pretty quickly. We didn't do all the fine tuning of the music and stuff, but we put it together in enough shape that you could tell, okay, this is what it would sound like if this was the thing we were doing. And it's like, It's like close to the real thing, but not like all the way. And it gives you, with Homecoming, we did the same thing. We like prototyped that with like different actors and like before the scripts were final, and we listened to it and like we were like, okay, here's what was working here and here's what wasn't working. And oh, this section felt really long. And like, here's how Homecoming is our fiction podcast. Here's
the spy drama.
What works, you know, here's how much dialogue you can have in a scene and here's where the dialogue goes on too long. Right. And so that's something that like we have definitely, I think gotten good at.
All right. Here's the final topic that I promised I would talk about and I want to get into in the conclusion here. I remember in Startup where you said to Chris Sacca something like, you're looking for this kind of person. And it was basically the image of an ideal startup guy, young, no obligations, et cetera. I'm like a guy who, when I travel, I have to carry a car seat on the plane or something like that, that you gave this visual. And I said, how are you going to do it, Alex? How do you, considering that every episode takes at least three times as long to listen to and edit, probably more than that, than it does to record, how do you do that and still, you know, have a family and be there for them?
I think that it's just like you're, I don't know. Like, I think there's no answer other than you have to like a little bit buck the stereotype that like to start a startup means, you know, like devoting 80 hours a week to it. Because I don't have 80 hours a week to devote to my startup. And it's not the most important thing in my life. My family is the most important thing in my life. And so given that, that's the reality. And like, if that means that I will fail, then I guess I will fail. But I don't, so far it hasn't meant that. So far it's meant that I've just managed my time more wisely. And I have hard outs when I have to go and relieve the babysitter. And I have hard outs when I have to go and get my kids to school. And that's the way it is. And there's no way around it. And so because there's no way around it, I make it work.
You told the interviewer at Hack the Entrepreneur, another podcast, having that forces me to delegate.
Yeah.
That's it.
I think that's a big part of it too. It forces me to be more efficient with my own time. I think I remember when I was, before I had a family, when I had a job at This American Life, it was also very compelling. I worked way more hours as a junior producer at This American Life than I work now as the CEO of a startup, simply because I had more hours to work. And it didn't matter. I didn't have to be efficient because I always knew I could stay till 2 a.m. and get the thing done. So I would like play around on the internet or do whatever. Like, I think there's a big myth that like a lot of that 80-hour work that's happening at these startups isn't work. You know, it's like work that could be done in 40 hours if people had, you know, like solid constraints on either end. And I think I think that's part of it. And then part of it is, yeah, I had to get way better at delegating, which is good for an organization. I think that's like a bad habit that a lot of founders have, is that I'll just do it myself because I can just put in the extra 40 hours a week and I can't put in those extra 40 hours. So I have to entrust people with these awesome responsibilities that otherwise I would be taking on myself and like driving myself crazy and everybody else with.
You know what? I'm sorry. Do you have 2 more minutes?
2 more minutes, yes.
Okay, 2 more minutes. I was trying to figure out where you got your traffic. I'm now looking at similarweb.com. Do you know this site? It tells you where traffic gets. Okay, so it's saying The Atlantic is one source of traffic for you. The Guardian is another. New York Times is another. And so as we're talking, researching what you're doing with those sites, it seems like you're quoted a lot in media. And also that Matt Lieber gets quoted. That seems like another way that you guys have raised your profile, right?
Yeah. We've raised our profile. Is that traffic to our website or is that traffic to...
Traffic to the site, which doesn't necessarily...
Which isn't... Like the site is like a fraction of the overall sort of like interaction that we have with our users. The vast majority of our users is through audio, which... that drives a little bit of traffic, like press drives a little bit of traffic, but we can see the spikes in listening that comes after, like we got mentioned in a bunch of best of lists and stuff like that. And it's an effect, but it's nothing like the effect of going on, you know, another podcast of a pretty large size.
I see. That does seem like a big one. Yeah. Like the article that I see here is 50 best podcast episodes of 2015 and Belt Buckle by The Mystery Show is one. And there are a bunch of others. I guess that's raising, but it's not the same as people listening here.
And driving traffic to our site isn't the same as driving. That doesn't help us. Like that doesn't count as an impression with our advertisers necessarily if they're as listening impressions. So,
all right. I paid $1,000 to get you on here, by the way. Yeah. I'd pay $50,000. So it was actually a good deal for me.
Yeah.
Ira Glass is another guy on my list. You've worked with him. Give me like an angle as a person. If you were me, what would you say to Ira to say, Ira, you should go to Mixergy?
He's picky and weird. And I love Ira. I think I would have to say your chances are very slim of booking him. He's really hard to book now. I have a hard time getting, you know, like getting a drink with him every once in a while. So, he's very, very particular about what he likes to do. And I think, but you know, you keep trying. Can't hurt to try.
I feel like peanut brittle or something weird like that is the quirky way to his heart. No.
It's just, I don't think there's not an answer. It's just going to be like, he's one of those guys. He just gets like requests, multiple requests every day. So you're one of that. You're one of the.
Oh, I thought I was the only one who recognized like how good he was, and like, I got to get him on the podcast. All right, yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah. All right.
I'm going to close it out by suggesting that people listen to two podcasts. Frankly, you have a bunch. We mentioned Heavyweight, Homecoming, so many others. Yeah, I'm going to say, of course, The Startup, but everyone here probably has already heard The Startup. And if they haven't, now they're going to go check it out and see. The Startups is really good. I think Reply All. It's such a freaking quirky thing. The first time they came on, they said, and don't forget to check out our website. It's at replyall.limo. I go, that limo? Yeah. Who the hell does that? And they never mentioned it again.
Yeah.
Like they finally branded my head. Now they're replyall. I don't know what.
Yeah, no, they registered a bunch of like weird domain names. .limo, .diamonds,
Right.
Like .kiwi, I think. Yeah, a bunch of them. Yeah.
I'm such a big fan of theirs. And if you listen, there's a very good chance you'll hate it, and there's a very good chance you'll love it. But I'm telling you, you'll really appreciate that what you're doing is not like what was available on terrestrial radio. There's a certain like thing there that makes it so special. And I'm honored to have you on here. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you so much. It was really fun.
You bet. Thank you all for being a part of it. Bye, everyone. And don't forget, toptal.com/Mixergy, designcrowd.com/Mixergy. Bye, Alex.
All right.